Hello, all. Welcome to the God Said Most podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm the editor of Kaidra Kona's Books, which is an anarchist independent press publishing socially engaged literature. With me, as always, are the other two editors of Kaidra Kona's Books, Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger. We are going to discuss two short story collections, both by Ted Chiang, I'm not exactly sure, probably Ted Chiang is how you say it. His collections, Exhalation and Stories of Your Life and Others. Basically, they're both collections of sci-fi stories, and, you know, I don't know if talking about genre is something that we are going to do in this podcast. Probably not that much because, hell, I don't even know if it's a useful term, to be honest. But, yeah. So, Chris, you picked these two books. And, you know, I on the whole, my feeling is at their best, these are some really enjoyable stories, you know. But, you know, and, you know, at their worst, they're not horrible. So that was like the worst ones aren't really bad. You know, the worst ones are, you know, I think, I don't know what my least favorite one would be. Maybe one of the shorter ones that are just kind of like, eh. Like yeah. the one about the parrot, where it's like, it's kind of neat, but although I did like the robot nanny one, which is a shorter one, that's pretty neat. But anyway, Chris, you know, it's your pick. So where do you want to start?
Yeah, I think that I'm sort of in a weird way happy that we read both to kind of talk about. Because Ted Chiang really hasn't written that much in the 30 years that he's been active. And he's achieved a level of celebrity that's pretty rarefied in especially short story writing.
He doesn't have any novels or anything, does he? He's just got these two collections.
He's got these two collections, and I'm almost as much, and I don't know if this is a good path to take, but I'm almost interested in talking about why he's successful as much as, and sort of, and maybe talking about his craft as a path to get to that. Because I feel like you said it, like some of his really interesting ones, some of his better stories in these two collections really do, I think they affect me, but not for sort of like, not because they necessarily do an interesting job of exploring characters. These are all kind of like dramatic thought experiments.
Right, right. They're all kind of like idea stories as opposed to character stories.
Yeah, and I'm like, yeah, and some of the more interesting ones manage to, I think, do something really interesting with characters that are very rational in very sort of rational realized universes, where like I'm thinking of the title piece of Exhalation, where you have a sort of like a I guess like an underwater robot scientist in a basically studying his universe, which is a steel globe filled with water. If I'm describing that right, and sort of he's
I didn't water.
No, it's a fluid.
It's argon.
Argon.
I mean, they refer to it as argon, and I looked it up, and I believe that is a real. I mean, it's a real substance. I don't that
yeah,
particular
but it,
story.
Argon's
I don't.
Argon's a gas. Well, I guess it's a gas. It's depends on what the temperature is.
Right.
Yeah.
It's an element that can take a liquid form.
Yeah, a liquid. Sorry, a liquid. or a heavier than air that allows them to, you know, basically use the less dense air to basically operate their brains and bodies and things like that.
Right.
And he's studying his universe and he's rationally exploring it. That's a pretty common theme among these. You have characters butting up against sort of explicit weird rules of their of the context of the story and how they navigate that sort of like is the arc of the drama of the story.
Right.
And so I think that the very interesting ones are interesting for getting you to think about the context more than the characters. And I guess like the obvious connections would be like Borges or who's another famous one? Borges is the one that comes to mind.
Right.
And so maybe a you know, kind of drawing a connection between Chiang and Borges. But also
Kafka a little bit too.
Kafka, yeah. But also like you know, I'm curious why these are such a big deal. I don't mean for that to belittle them. I think that some of them just kind of like ones that I'd be interested in talking about really explicitly. I actually really liked Tower of Babylon. I loved Hell is the Absence of God. Exhalation, Merchant and the Alchemist Gate. You know, Amphalos to some extent. You know, like some of them really got me thinking, you know, in interesting about interesting things, but not really about the characters. And Patrick was saying, and this is true. Life cycle of software objects is more because of the nature of the sort of thought experiment. It puts characters at a point of sort of crisis where a choice, a moral choice, between two sort of distasteful outcomes is actually sort of explored, and so it does feel a little bit more character driven. But I don't know, like maybe I didn't do a very good job of setting the table, Patrick.
No, but I mean, you started to talk about Exhalation, and that's one of the, you know, I when you asked me what my favorite one is, that was the other front runner. Exhalation is, you know, really, really dig that story. And since you already mentioned it, maybe we could start there. Maybe if you want, we could talk about, you know, like Craft doesn't seem to be like a major mystery here. Like, you know, for this short story, it's told in first person. And it's basically, He tells it in past tense, and he's like, you know, telling the story of how basically he did this experiment on our brain on his brain to figure out how, you know, what generates consciousness in basically it's like a species of robots or something like that, and he finds out that it's not any mechanism that is in the brain. It's actually the flow of argon through these like gold plated filaments in the brain creates consciousness. And of course, this is extremely interesting. And to me, it's extremely interesting because this is essentially the functionalist account of consciousness, right? Like, we don't know if there is a physical mechanism that causes consciousness, so plenty of philosophers have said that, like, hey, it's probably the result of, it's probably an emergent thing, right? Like, all these different processes just kind of together create consciousness. So I thought that comparison was pretty neat, but, you know, I don't know.
But kind of connects that with an entropy, which is like the function of living is a transference of energy that basically produces that expended energy in the form of argon is as it sort of equalizes the pressure of their universe.
Yeah, because
that's not recoverable.
Right.
As I understand it, the kind of the shock of the story is that their universe, they will die in their universe, because at some point the ability for them to function, their ability to function requires argon to remain in a pressurized state, right? And
right.
At some point, all the argon will have become depressurized. And, I mean, there's a shock there, but the underlying, I don't know if you'd call it a joke necessarily, but the underlying joke there is that we live in a version of that same universe, right? That
right.
At some point, the action of entropy will kind of burn out the universe in some sense. Or, I mean, there are
right.
people who believe that it will. I don't think that it's 100% known to be sure, but that's one of the leading theories of the eventual end of the universe, right? As kind of entropy overtakes and everything kind of reaches a sort of state of equal distribution.
Right.
I don't have nearly enough scientific background to say that in ways that, I mean, I'm sure that sounds stupid to, you know, people who have more training in it, but they're living in a version of our universe.
So the question, Patrick, because you really like this story, and I do too, but is it, I think it's really kind of bewitching, like, all the detail in it as we're
right.
thinking of, like, sort of learning about this species and their, you know, just sort of unique, like, life. But why not just, you know, a one-page sort of thought experiment? You know, what do we get out of this being a story? You know, with the main character, and maybe it's kind of in the end. Why not the thought experiment that just sort of lays out this sort of like very concisely this sort of like this scenario.
Well, it's not. I don't, you know, when you use the term thought experiment, I think it does, it sounds true, but the function of the story isn't the same as the function of a thought experiment in philosophy, right? Like he's not necessarily trying to prove anything so much as trying to get us to think about the limits of our own lives, maybe, like what our own consciousness means.
Does a thought experiment, I don't know, like, does it like sort of formally have to try to prove something, or can it be the basis for exploring a concept?
Yeah. I think thought experiment is a good word. I definitely like calling these thought experiments.
I think to the question of why does it have to be a story, if it weren't a story, we wouldn't be talking about it, right? I'm sure that there are, if you really wanted to seek them out, I'm sure there are lots of places where you can find one-page descriptions of theoretical universes, such
right.
as this one, right? But the... one of the questions that you came in with, Chris, is why, I mean, you framed it, I think, as why are these successful, but maybe a kinder way to think of the question would be, why do these speak to people, right? Why do these find an audience that engages so passionately? Well, maybe passionately is the wrong word, but why does this find the audience that it does, and, I mean, achieve the level of, you know, this is one of those books, and I feel like I talk a lot on this podcast about the quotes on the back jacket, which makes it seem like I don't read the books and I'm trying to fake my way through it. But these are both examples of those books where like the back cover quotes are so breathless that you kind of come into actually reading the text from kind of an adversarial standpoint, right? Like, Ted is a national treasure. Each of these stories is a goddamn jewel. Like, there are almost no writers about whom I would express that level of breathless
right.
enthusiasm, right? Just right. full stop, nobody. So the question is, like, why does this achieve, why does this generate that level of, passion? And, I mean, I think one of the answers is that, you know, you guys, you mentioned that these aren't generally very character-driven stories, and I absolutely think that you're right about that, but there is enough, there's a pretty smart balance here, I think, between having just enough they're not character-driven stories, but the characters are just present enough that you don't recognize, the characters are just present enough that you're not going to have an issue with how character is used, right? The characters are present enough and full enough that you're not going to think, oh boy, this is an interesting thought experiment, but I'm put off by how shallow these characters are, right?
Right.
They're given enough life and enough flesh to make the concepts resonate emotionally, but then
and
not so much life and flesh that they become, that they take the spotlight away from the concept.
And I think that this story in particular, Exhalation, is good, is really good at achieving this balance, because on the one hand, a lot of the story is like fleshing out the details, but it's also told in the first person, and it's like has this very essayistic personal reflection, personal essay quality. And what one thing I really liked is, you know, when I was focusing on nonfiction, when I was focusing writing more creative essays as opposed to fiction, you know, one thing that you do when you're doing that is you balance the story, like the narrative you're telling, with your own reflection, and I think that's actually pretty neat how it's done in this particular essay, where we get kind of glimpses into what the robot scientist feels, and the, you know, the description of him like looking into his own brain.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was really well done. Like, we get a good sense that this guy, you know, has found out something profound about his universe and is now having to emotionally deal with the ramifications.
Right. And he is, I mean, you know really very little about that character, but the one thing that you do know is that he's intelligent and courageous in a particular way, right? So he has a small number of admirable qualities. The fact that he carries out those admirable qualities is what leads us through the contours of the thought experiment, right? So the little bit that we know about the character makes the character engaging and serves to energize the forward movement of the kind of process of discovering the rules of the universe.
Right.
So it's all meshed together very well in construction, I think, in that regard.
Do other stories in Exhalation or stories, the other one,
Stories of Your Life and Others.
I shortened it to stories, and I realized that was a problem. do they function in similar ways? Like, do they? Because, you know, it does seem interesting that first person is used
a
in
lot.
These stories, used so much when those. I tell me if I'm off base in this. I kind of feel like, sort of the narrator, is not meant to stand out so much. Are they just basically an avatar for the reader? Why the first person in most in a lot of these stories, and I'm going through. Not all of them are, right? Like Alchemist Gate is.
Not all of them are, but the ones that are not first person generally, I think, tend to be ones that have some kind of gimmick in how they're framed, right? Like Dacey's Patton Automatic Nanny, right? Where
Right.
the structural gimmick is that it's from a catalog accompanying an exhibit. Or I can't remember the titles of half of these, but the one at the end of the first collection, Liking What You
Liking
See,
What You
right?
See,
Where
yeah.
the structural gimmick is that it's a documentary, right? I mean, I off the top of my head, I'd say probably the use of first person, I think, is, you know, if there's kind of a psychological immediacy that you get from first person that makes it very easy to establish things like character traits, right? And if you
Right.
want the character aspect of the story to move as efficiently as possible, so that to some extent it can kind of get out of the way of the conceptual stuff, then the first person is maybe just kind of an easy reflex. It's
That's actually an excellent thought, Hans. That reminds me a lot of like the way, say, Edgar Allan Poe would use first person in his stories, you know, to get the character out of the way so that we can just have the concept. That's super neat. Thanks for saying that. Go on.
Well, and I was going to say there are a certain number of some of the longer stories tend to be third person, right? Like Anxiety is the Dizziness of Freedom, and yeah, and I think in both of those instances, they because of the nature of the worlds being inhabited. Well, for one thing, those are both longer stories, right? And I mean, maybe part of that length again is because third person is a little less efficient in certain ways, but I think also the those are both stories that juggle multiple perspectives, I think because they have to, because of the nature of the concept, right?
Yeah, and Hell is the Absence of God, also third person, and that's really interesting. I'm still like I like Patrick. I really appreciate what you're saying about how first person actually gets the it gets allows you to sort of foreground enough with the character to basically move past that into the like what Chang is very interested in, which are these problems in concept, and I never thought about that before.
Are there kind of on the same topic, and I'm not fishing for anything in particular here, but I'm wondering, were there any stories where the you had this is kind of a simple way to say it. I wish I could frame it a little bit more articulately, but just any stories where you had issues aesthetically with the characters, where they bothered you, or you didn't like how they were handled, or where the use of characters seemed like a weakness?
Understand, I felt like was not compelling to me. It
I can't
felt
remember which one that was.
that's the one in stories about your life that is sort of, and it's long actually too. It's pretty
Oh,
big.
that's the one about the very intelligent person.
Yeah, the very intelligent person, and
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And he,
You
like,
know,
becomes super, like, almost omniscient, right?
yeah.
one thing that I. And were you going to say more about that? I'm sorry. I had a thought that I got
Yeah, j well,
excited,
just
but.
I basically to answer your question, I feel like the problem with that is he rose the examination of character to sort of archetype, like basically, like the character, basically in that story, the speaker becomes super intelligent. And basically, to the extent that there is no, like, normal human beings pose no threat to him. And he is kind of like a god walking among us. Unfortunately, he is surprised to find that another version, another person has risen to the same level. They go at it in the end. And then there's like this kind of, I feel like a jab. And I think he said it's his oldest story. Because like there's this jab in the end where we're, you know, this sort of self-centered speaker, narrator, is juxtaposed against another version, another person with similar powers who's more interested in basically social structure, like not so self-interested. And I felt like none of the structures that Chiang built in that story didn't quite make that story work for me. And it was in something in the handoff of that character's characterization and the type of sort of thought experiment he was trying to do. It didn't land for me in the same way.
You know what I think is distinct about that story, actually? And maybe as I form this thought, I'll realize that it's wrong, but like, so there are a couple of different buckets that these stories tend to fall into, right? And I mean, there are outliers around this, but like broadly speaking, like there are some stories that go in, there's like a bucket of stories where he takes an idea from religion or mythology and envisions a world in which that were literally scientifically true, and then has people sort through the consequences of that, right? And define the parameters of that world.
Couple of them like that.
Yeah, like Omphalos does that. The one about angels does that. Tower of Babylon does that.
Hell is
right?
The absence of God.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's like a quirk of his almost, right? And maybe there are other authors who do that. I don't read sci-fi and fantasy a lot, so maybe that's a common structure for a story, but it seems like a very particular kind of Ted Changism, right? And then the other kind of bucket that a lot of these fall into is what you might think of as a more conventional science fiction framing, in which you take some piece of contemporary scientific thought or some pending piece of technology and just kind of imagine how that would play out in people's
right.
lives, right? Like the one about, I can't remember what it's called, the Caliagnosia one, or the...
I thought that one was a really good one, actually. I enjoyed it a lot. But anyway.
Or the... Yeah, the Caliagnosia one, or the one about the software entities, right?
Yeah, life cycle.
Or the one... it's called Truth of Fact, Truth of Feeling. The one about having perfect recall through, like, a video camera built into your brain.
That one's a bit of a snooze.
Yeah, but where I'm going with this, like, the reason I want to define these two buckets is, like, in stories that go into the second bucket that are about envisioning some, like, piece of technology that's sort of an extrapolation from current thought, right? A lot of those are more optimistic than you might expect, right? Like, another thing that I think defines some of these stories is there's actually a tone of optimism above what we're used to from a lot of sci-fi, right? Like Truth of Fact, Truth of Feeling in particular, not necessarily a great story relative to some of the others, but one thing that I thought about while I was reading it is that this is almost like a Black Mirror episode, right? Like, there is a Black
Mirror
episode that does that handles exactly this concept. But whereas Black Mirror always manages to, like, push things into the kind of darkest possibility, the darkest version of themselves,
right,
in a way that I think has kind of become, it achieves a kind of self-parody with that I think is kind of to the detriment of that show.
Yeah, yeah, it's worn itself out, I think.
One of the ways it's worn itself out is through that that reflexive pessimism, right?
Right, right.
And with a lot of how Chiang handles things, there's kind of like a reflexive optimism, or not a
right.
reflexive optimism, but a greater degree of optimism than you're used to, I think, and than I'm used to in a lot of the science fiction that I've encountered. And the story Understand, the story about the super intelligent superhumans, that seems like it comes more from kind of a dystopian sci-fi. It has kind of the reflexive darkness and bleakness of something like a Black Mirror. And that, I think, marks it maybe as an earlier work of Chang's. And also, I think, makes it tonally kind of off a bit relative to some of the other stuff in these, relative to the larger sort of body of work.
Right.
It's interesting that you say that, because I feel like I'm thinking, and I'm trying to sort of go through the stories in my brain that do operate in a religious context. And it seems as though the common thread through those, or a common thread, is basically our hopelessness necessarily, but our lack of agency or control over the context. And sci-fi is basically us achieving agency and control over the context. And I'm thinking of Follows here, where I'd love to talk to Patrick, because I know that he didn't like it the first time, but I really do like Follows still.
I liked it more the second time. Before we move away from Understand, though, I feel like there's a couple other questions I had about it that I wondered if we could keep talking about it for a second.
Sure, yeah. What were your questions?
Well, okay, so one, I'll go with the easy one first. And it's always been a pet peeve of mine when a story is written in first person, but the character ends up dying. does that piss anybody else off? Like, I mean, I think that it's I don't know. It irritates me.
Isn't there a famous novel that is written like in the moments that a bullet is traveling through the narrator's head? Not famous, but like just a. I think the writer is what maybe better known for other stuff. I'm trying to think of what it is.
Well, I'm thinking of a novel. What? Rich Carr had me read it for like a
God
review.
God damn it, Rich Carr! Letting that guy make you read stuff.
And it was about like these two. It was about corruption in an Australian cricket league, and it's told in first person, but it's not revealed until the end that it's being told while the main character is being kidnapped in the back, in the trunk of a car, and then like the final line is like him getting hit on the head and killed, and I'm like, what? So I don't know. That's just a pet peeve, and if it doesn't bother either of you, we don't have to talk about it anymore. But I did want to say that I think that in Understand, we were originally talking about why we don't think it's that great, and one reason is I feel like the characterization is extremely weak in the story. And you said, Chris, like he gradually, like as he learns more and more and becomes more omniscient, he becomes less human. But I actually don't like that. There's an episode of Futurama called Overclockwise, in which Bender gets an upgrade from one of the Planet Express crew. And basically, this upgrade puts him in the same position as the narrator of this story. And, you know, yes, he does, like, he basically becomes so omniscient that he can see every point in time, but he doesn't actually lose his personality. He's still, like, Bender the jerk. You know, he's still, you know, interested in farting so that atomic particles can be born. You know, whereas with Understand, we don't have any sense of character depth like that, and I think that's one reason why it feels a little weak to me. So
I
don't know.
It feels like. Oh, go ahead.
I think part of the reason you don't have a sense of character depth there is that like normally you have like the character and the concept, but in this one the character is the concept, and he wasn't quite able to thread that needle as effectively as he might have been, I think, later in his career.
And before we move on, this story also reminded me of a film called LFO. Have you guys seen it?
No.
Isn't that a band?
I don't know if it is a band, but it is a...
Yeah, it's a band.
Yeah, it stands for Light Funky Ones.
You're fucking with us.
No,
no,
it
there's
is,
really
it
a band called LFO, and it stands for Light Funky Ones. Light is spelled L-Y-T-E. Yeah, it's
their,
like,
are you really into their they did kind of like a Tommy-like video, Patrick. You know, just sort of like a big Light Funky Ones concept.
Anyway,
film. That's what you're talking about?
No. It's a movie called LFO, and it stands for Low Frequency Oscillator. Hopefully you guys knew that. And does not stand for Light Funky Ones, because that's stupid.
It's also light with an Y-T-E. It's an L-Y-T-E.
Anyway, I highly... The film, this story also reminded me of the film LFO. The film is about a guy who gets, basically becomes omnipotent, not omniscient, through the development of a hypnotic technique that requires LFOs. And it's super good, really great. I suggest you you both watch it so we can talk about it. It's hilarious.
Okay.
It's like really dark black
funny.
Comedy. Super fucking hilarious. Oh my god, it's so funny. I want you guys to watch it so much. So we could fucking
right.
laugh about it. It's great. Watch it. Anyway, go on.
I'm just going to jump kind of back, because I'm thinking about the religious context stories and how they do. I'm trying to think of Amphalos and Hell is the Absence of God.
It's interesting, both Hell in the Absence of God and Amphalos kind of, it like leaves characters in the same place, you know, like they're, it's like, hey, God doesn't give a shit about you guys.
Yeah,
you
well,
know?
No, God doesn't care about your choices.
Right,
God doesn't
exactly.
care, like in, and that's I really love, and actually Tower of Babylon too. And Tower of Babylon, though I think that there's parts of it that are just sort of, Tower of Babylon is like a story that I think any science fiction or speculative writer could have written. But then in like the larger sort of like oeuvre of this, like I think about it in a different way, and I appreciate it in a different way, and it's very good. But like the character who basically climbs up the tower, digs through the vault of heaven, and finds himself back on Earth, basically crawling up through the ground underneath his own feet. And then the epiphany that he has at the end, that this is all basically the curvature of the universe, like the perfect curvature of the universe that God created for us to marvel at, is actually extraordinarily silly. You know, like, there's no reason, like, the fact that, like, or not silly, it's just not scientific, right? Like,
right.
It's sort of like, oh my God, the reason this is the way it's so weird is because God wants us to marvel at how weird it is.
Right.
It's almost like a Twilight Zone ending.
It is like a Twilight Zone ending.
Except the guy's happy.
The guy's happy.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, I think of that in Hell is the Absence of God and Amphalos. And there's a weird kind of bittersweet is not the right word, but like, because Hell's the Absence of God is, it ends with so much hopelessness. But Amphalos has a human agency element that's sort of uplifting. It's just that all three of them basically create a world. They conceptualize, you know, like if God exists, if we live in a universe that was created by a god, that god, our decision whether we love that god or or don't love or just disregard them or whatever is really like immaterial. It's our choices are arbitrary. Like we're yeast, you know, to
right.
kind of go back to what was it, the sea wolf. I think Wolf Larson calls us yeast, and the fact that we make such a big deal over our own like faith or lack thereof is absolutely fucking ludicrous. You know, like we like Amphalos, or hell is the absence of God. It doesn't like, you know, it's not a moral test. It's basically do you love your daddy or do you not love your daddy? Cause your daddy will, you know, spank you and ignore you. And his friends will just sort of show up and blow your, you know, wife to pieces. And there's no rhyme or reason to any of it. And Amphalos, your dad gave birth to you and didn't even know it, you know, like, and there is just so much hopelessness in that context and lack of control and agency that I feel like it does sort of juxtapose against, you know, some of the other sci-fi ones. Maybe Life Cycle is a little bit different because in that way, in Life Cycle, advent of technology, like technology is almost sort of like this thing that like progresses and technology and capitalism and like just sort of progressing forward and all the characters in that have no real agency or control over that,
right?
But I don't know, I guess like this is a long sort of arc and a really wobbly one to sort of talk about, like, these characters are not necessarily the most interesting or vivid, but it does seem like he's interested in their agency or lack thereof.
In the Life Cycle?
In all of these stories.
Oh,
all
right.
To one extent or another. Even Understand. We're talking so much about Understand, and it was maybe my least favorite. But, like, he finds himself pitted against this other, like, superhuman person. And explicitly says, like, there is no reasoning. We have not even spoken, and yet we know what must be. We have to fight. And it's, I don't know what that says, whether these stories are largely deterministic, whether Chiang sort of reflexively creates these contexts or scenarios for the stories to happen within, in which all the information exists and is quantifiable, and all the dominoes, you know, like, there's no threat of chaos. Everything seems to just sort of be predetermined.
I think that
maybe that's part of it being these being concept stories. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to think about Merchant and the Alchemist's Gate in that context, right? Because that's, I mean, for one thing, that's such an interesting story relative to kind of his larger, yeah, I was talking a little bit earlier about kind of the categories of story that he tends to write, you know, and that's an interesting one because it has some aspects of a religious story and some aspects of a more conventional science fiction story, and they're blended in ways that don't, the religious and the sci-fi aspects are blended in a very interesting way there that seems just kind of qualitatively different from how he uses those things in a lot of his other stories, right? But one thing that is interesting about that story is that in a lot of the other pieces, and I don't know if I could cite examples of this if I were pinned to the mat on it, but I feel like in a lot of the other pieces, like the discovery, there's always a little bit of a sense of like horror around discovering that lack of agency, right? And Merchant and the Alchemist's Gate is the, like, it's fundamentally about lack of agency in the sense that, you know, it's about time loops and the inevitability of, even with a time machine, you can't change the past because everything is a time loop and the past already occurred with you going into it, right? But that becomes a source of comfort for those characters, right? Like the within kind of this Islamic idea of submission to the will of God, rather than the time loop being a, like, rather than the lack of agency you get from the time loop being a negative surprise, it achieves a form of comfort, right? It as opposed to like there's a, around the time that I was reading this, I've for the last year or so I've been trying to work through the complete short stories of J.G. Ballard, and some of his early writing in the 60s is very, very conventional sci-fi. And one of his early stories is about someone who travels back in time to try to prevent the murder of his wife, and then discovers that the death of his wife was caused by him traveling back in time, right? So, oh my gosh, you can't change the past. So it's not a good story, right? It's a very, even at that point, I think it was a relatively cliched way of working with that idea. And the interesting thing, I'd mentioned earlier kind of the optimism that characterizes a lot of these stories relative to how other writers might have handled them. And I think that the way in which the kind of closed circuit of the time loop actually becomes a source of comfort through a religious filter is just very, it's very interesting. It's very different. And it's determinism as comfort in a way that is unusual for, it's unusual, I don't know, I'm trailing off there a little bit.
I really like that take on determinism. I think that, you know, now I'm just talking personally, like I think people, you know, are terrified of the idea of determinism, and I'm not exactly sure why, but I think it's an interesting take, especially like in comparison to anxiety is a form of dizziness. Is that the name of it?
Anxiety is the dizziness of freedom.
Anxiety is the dizziness of freedom, because like that story seems to be like it definitely is like, well, we, you know, we are in control of our choices. We are in. So from my understanding, you know, I've been doing a lot of research on this subject for the novel I'm currently writing. But from my understanding, the many worlds theory, like this idea that there are other quantum states that could be realized, is impossible if determinism is true. So, you know, if determinism is real, then there's no way that there can be these different quantum states. So I find it interesting that on the one hand we get a story where determinism is a comforting thing. And then another story that has the same kind of optimistic tone and hinges upon a character's decision to act differently at the end and do something kind for someone else. And that is all within the framework of this many worlds theory, so where determinism can't be true. So I think that's interesting that we get these two kind of contradictory, it's actually the book ending stories, right? Like the first story of Exhalation. So I wonder if that is like.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it might just be part of the answer to that might be that those are different concepts, those are different worlds, right? So
right.
It's okay if there's some contradiction between the two. That Chang isn't somebody who, he's not necessarily trying to make consistent philosophical or ideological arguments across the collection, right?
You just start. We are determinism or we're not. Right.
Right. You start with an idea and you follow it to its conclusion, right. And then that's. Although I do think that it's interesting, maybe to also compare the two stories you talked about to the title the title story, Story of Your Life, right? Where it's
in
another
the other,
story.
In the other one.
Yeah, which is another story that's not it's not religiously framed at all, but it is still about constructing a way of understanding a deterministic universe as comforting,
right?
Which is very interesting.
Yeah,
in I think really a fairly persuasive way.
Right. Sure.
Have you guys watched, this is kind of a digression, I apologize, but have you watched the HBO show Los Espookies?
Never heard of it.
It's about, I think it's set in Mexico. It's about these three, it's primarily in Spanish, but it's about these four people who are trying to start a business where they construct spooky events for money, you know, like people will pay them to scare people essentially through like fake supernatural occurrences.
That's funny.
And one of the characters, there are only six episodes of it, it's this little self-contained thing, but one of the characters is just kind of like for most of the show, like one of the running jokes is that she's an idiot and she's ridiculous and she's always doing these like making terrible decisions, like you know, spending $200,000 on a multi-level marketing scheme, right? And then, you know, she has to figure out how to pay back this 200 grand to this multi-level marketing company, stuff like that, right? And at the very end of the show, and again, the tone of this show is very ridiculous, it's very silly, it's very goofy. And at the end of the show, like this kind of deus ex machina happens and she's saved from having to pay back the 200 grand. And somebody's like, wow, like you really got your ass saved, even though you made a bunch of dumb choices. And she says, oh, well, the thing about me is that I experience all events in a circular fashion where I see the I see the past and the future at once rather than linear time. So I knew it was going to work out. That's why I act the way I do, which... I watched that around the time that I was reading the collection Stories of Your Life, and it's like,
hilarious.
Oh, you're making fun of a rival, aren't you? Like, I assume that was a pretty direct kind of, taking the kind of end conceptual hook of that story and of the movie Arrival and making it stupid, but...
Hans, I'm curious because, like, you don't read a lot of sci-fi. Did any of these stories stick out to you particularly, like that you enjoyed or that you liked more than any of the others?
In a way where I thought, oh gosh, I should read more sci-fi. Maybe I'm underrating this show.
No, not necessarily that. No, just like ones that you were more, because I don't think that this is really in your, like, what you're really interested in. So I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely. It's definitely in the realm of things that I enjoyed and I really respected and I can totally see the appeal of, but I don't love, right? Like, it's, you know, there's things that you like and then there's things that you kind of feel personal ownership through your love of them. Mm-hmm. And this definitely is not something I feel personal ownership through my love of, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, but I mean, I actually, the Tower of Babylon story, something about that worked really well for me. I really enjoyed that. And that's really not a conventional sci-fi story at all. Mm-hmm. And I really can't articulate why, but there was something I found pleasing about that. And even like there's something about like that end hook where they, you know, pop up through the floor and realize they've gone in a big circle. As silly as it is, there was something about like in that moment that had a little bit of a, I don't know, that resonated. I'm not sure why. And actually, the Alchemist's Gate, I really liked that one too.
Yeah,
I did really enjoy that.
Yeah, I love that story too.
There's, I guess there's just something about like something that can be that. I mean, it's almost sentimental, right? But it's skillful enough that it pulls off the sentiment. And right. I mean, I think anytime that I can have like a nice reaction to something that is, anytime I encounter something that you could, that could be sentimental if it were less skillfully handled, but that's like done well enough to earn the sentiment, I do appreciate that, you know.
And what a, you know, that makes me interested in another question, Han, specifically for you, because I know, you know, we've talked mm-hmm. a lot about Philip K. Dick, and I've been reading, you know, I'm a recent kind of convert to Dick. I've only, yeah. You know, in the last year or so really gotten into his writing, and I was wondering, I know you said you got into him young when you were younger. And I was thinking, you know, what was your, you know, if you would say you're not a big sci-fi fan, what's your draw to PKD?
Well, I think as far as getting into Philip K. Dick when I was younger, most of that was just, this is what's in the house, you know.
Oh, okay, sure.
But I mean, it is, I have continued to appreciate his work as I've gotten older, and kind of, you know, found different ways to appreciate it than I did when I was a teenager. Probably when I was a teenager, actually, I didn't like it that much. I just read it because I was bored.
Oh,
I think what
sure.
I like about Philip K. Dick, part of it is the ragged quality, right?
Right.
Where everything,
sure.
it you know, most of his novels he wrote in a 6-week amphetamine binge, right? That was just his method. Was like you come up with an outline, then you have a 6-week amphetamine binge, and you tear the whole thing out and move on, right?
Oh, jeez.
And that gives them.
Maybe I should take amphetamines to finish my novel.
I tried, actually.
Did
and,
you?
And I mean, Ritalin. Yeah, when I was younger, I found Ritalin very helpful as a creative aid.
Yeah.
And then something happened around when I turned 30, where like stimulants in general really flatten my affect now. Like they make everything. It's the same thing with cocaine. Like I can't be creative when I'm on cocaine or Ritalin or Adderall because all my emotional responses are blunted, so I can
right.
make great quantities of product, but I don't have any emotional response to like what I'm creating.
Sure.
So, you know, that's a total aside. But I mean, what I like about Philip K. Dick, I think, yeah, is the kind of the weirdness, the off-kilterness, the way there's, you know, a lot of play in the joints, the unresolvedness. I think those are qualities that make him impenetrable to a lot of people mm. or off-putting to a lot of people, but they're actually what I appreciate about him. And I think like the most of the works of his that I like the most are kind of outside. He's kind of moving beyond what you'd really call sci-fi, right?
Right.
Something like A Scanner Darkly. Like A Scanner Darkly is basically a drug squalor novel
with a little
bit of sci-fi thrown in so he could get someone to publish it.
It's a great novel, but you're absolutely right. Transmigration I was going to say
yes,
Transmigration
yes.
of Timothy Archer reminds me of that, where like the only yep. gimmick is, you know, this ancient religious text that may or may not bring somebody back to life.
Right.
Which I just read not too long ago. And
there's a way that his characters talk and a way that he narrates, and just that I find very appealing. But yeah, the old stuff I like because it's weird and flimsy. The newer stuff I like because it's not really sci-fi.
But and I think it's anyway, actually sorry. Interesting to note that like there, you know, PKD is a sci-fi writer, but like he's totally different than Chang. You know, if Chang were to write Dewey Andrews' Dream of Electric Sheep, we'd be asking mm-hmm. all the questions that you would think that Dick would have asked but didn't. Like, is this ethical?
Right.
You
right.
know, things like that. And really, you know, PKD is just like, I don't know. I don't know what he's trying to get at.
He's about as uninterested in questions of actual science as you can really imagine a sci-fi writer.
Right, absolutely.
Which I think is another thing that, that people criticize about him. And you do, you know, there are certain things that people will sometimes point to as Dick being prophetic, but those have to do with social trends, not scientific trends, right? Mm. Like, I think there's, I don't remember what novel it is, but there's a line where somebody makes a reference to like, we'll watch the evening news delivered by the evening news clown. Right. And it's like now we do, in fact, get our news from News Clown. But like that's a social trend, not a scientific one.
Right.
Or that there's a.
We should do.
I was just going to say in the novel Flow My Tears, the policeman said one of the jokes is that the singer who is kind of the main character he does these croony lounge songs that all have titles like Baby Let's Fuck. And it's like now, in fact, we have essentially all our pop stars are basically doing croony lounge songs called Baby Let's Fuck. Right? But again, social trends, not scientific.
Cardi B's WAP.
Right. Yeah. Sorry, what were you going to say, Chris?
I was going to say we should do a PKD for one of these.
I think eventually I'll choose one. I think
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think when I want to read a Scanner Darkly again, I'll probably choose it.
I do adore that novel. So do we have any closing thoughts about Ted Chiang? Anything we want to wrap up with?
Understand sucked, but there were a lot of other good ones.
I really want to give both these books to my dad.
Why?
I'm not sure if I can articulate why, but it's an urge that I'm having.
I wonder if my mom would like them. She's a big sci-fi fan.
Yeah. My dad really doesn't read that much fiction, but now and then.
So what's...
This isn't...
We keep talking over each other. No, go on, because I was going to wrap things up. So you go ahead first.
No, you wrap things up, because my thing was coming after. So,
Okay, Hans, what are you picking?
So I'm actually pretty excited about this one. I've been wanting to talk to somebody about this novel for a while, and there have just been other things that have gotten other things that I've chosen before it for whatever reason. So just a little bit of backstory on this choice. As you guys know, but this hasn't really ever come up in the show, I release albums. I write and release albums under the band name, under the project name, Electric Brain, Electric Shadow. And I just a couple weeks ago, put out an album called The Golem. And the inspiration for the album The Golem, among other things, was a novel. I think it was, I'm not sure where you'd class it in terms of movement. I think it's like roughly German expressionist, but it's from about 1914. And it's written by someone named Gustav Meyrink. So I read The Golem by Gustav Meyrink in spring of 2018, and was taken enough with it. I read it over the course of a week-long trip to Mexico, and I was also reading
Is that when you had that whale beer?
By David Markson. It's when I had the whale beer, yeah. Which longtime listeners may remember from our podcast about A Naked Singularity by Oscar de la Pava. So I read The Golem. I read The Golem by Gustav Meyrink, and I read Wittgenstein's Mistress by David Markson.
Mm.
And those, you know,
I've
ended up kind of spitting out Wittgenstein's Mistress.
Yeah,
it's good. It's good, and it's quick read. And I'm not picking that actually, because I do. The thing about The Golem is I don't really know what the hell it's doing. I love it, but I don't know that I could explain it to anybody.
So we
and
should talk
so
about it.
I would like to talk about it. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's my pick for the next episode is
Gustav
The Golem
Meyrink,
by Gustav Meyrink.
The Golem. Okay. All right. Cool.
And make sure There are two translations. The translation I read is by Mike Mitchell. I think the other translation is pretty hard to get a hold of. I don't know if you even can get the other translation because it was from about 1928. Every copy I've seen of it is very expensive. Mm. But just on the off chance that you're not sure, like, make sure that you're reading the Mike Mitchell translation, right? Because of much of what I found, much of what I found captivating about it, I think may have to do with sentence level writing choices that might have been as much translation as source.
Sure. Okay. So. Yeah, since listening to your latest novel, which, you know, your latest album, which I've told you before, I really, really enjoyed it, really thought it was great, except for this one underdone synthesizer part on a song towards the end. No, I'm just fucking with you. Actually, on re-listening several times to your album and getting to that point, I was like, actually, you made the right choice. You really did to tone it
it's
down.
It's the highest praise.
So,
thank you.
But
Patrick is setting aside his own contribution. He's saying his contribution. You were right to sort of
revise it,
tighten it up.
Tighten it up. Yeah. But yeah, it's a super great album, and. I think you mentioned that it was like a concept album for the novel, and you know I was intrigued, so I think this is a cool pick. I'm looking forward to it.
Sweet. Yeah, I'm the novel The Golem is I adore it, and I think that it might be deeply flawed. But it's inscrutable enough that I don't know for sure if it is in fact flawed or if I'm not understanding what it's doing. But I really enjoyed reading it both times that I've read it. I'm looking forward to going through it a third time, and I'll certainly be pleased to finally have somebody to talk to about it, because nobody else that I know has actually read it. So
cool. All right, listeners, you heard it from Hans. We're going to talk about Gustav Meyrink or Meyrink?
Meyrink.
All right. Gustav Meyrink's The Golem next time. So tune in for that. And until then, peace out.